I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. As Scott Taylor steps down, two women are going after his 6th District at-large seat on the Kansas City Council. Today, the candidates Andrea Boo and Stacey Johnson Cosby share their plans to address calls for more affordable housing and more economic development east of Troost. We'll also ask for their ideas to reduce violent crime citywide. Then it's estimated there are hundreds of thousands of human trafficking victims in the United States. We'll talk to the founding director of the Human Trafficking Institute about what human trafficking looks like and the efforts to combat it. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Two women who have not held elected public office before are vying for the 6th District at-large seat on the Kansas City Council. This is the seat that Scott Taylor has held for 8 years. He can't seek re-election because of term limits. This is a seat that every voter is eligible to vote on. The election is a week from today. We'll be electing a new mayor that day as well, and thank goodness this is the last race we've talked about here during our ongoing series of conversations with our city council candidates. The candidates for the 6th District at-large seat are Andrea Boo, who's a lawyer here in town. Andrea, welcome.
Thank you, Steve.
Stacey Johnson Cosby works as a real estate agent. Stacey, good morning to you.
Good morning.
What's the number one thing you want to accomplish, Andrea, should you win your race a week from today?
I think the number one thing I want to accomplish is to collaboratively work with the mayor, the next mayor, and the city council to fight the neighborhood issues that affect our various neighborhoods. And one of those issues is violent crime. Violent crime affects all of Kansas City, and that is something that we, as the next mayor and the next city council, need to address.
Stacey, your top priority.
Top priority is being a voice for the citizens. And I think at this point, a lot of us in Kansas City feel like we don't have a voice at City Hall and City Council. And I want to be that voice. And the things that are important to us and to me as a citizen would be issues related to neighborhoods and housing. We need to make sure our housing stock is complete and that it's in good repair, and that we have enough affordable housing for those who are in the range of $700 or less. Safety is important, public safety, and reducing violent crime, and making sure people have access to the jobs that are currently available in our city that are good-paying jobs.
Why have 6th District residents felt like they haven't had a voice at City Hall?
Well, for many things. A lot of our issues are the same issues that I've heard in the Northland, that they just feel like some of the neighborhood issues may not be addressed and may not be handled with the priority that it should be. The Northland feels the same way. But in South Kansas City, we feel, like a lot of the development that's happening is there, a lot of the economic development. But we need more focus on housing issues and making sure that our housing stock is not only up to date, but that we have more to address the needs that we have in the Southland.
Okay, we'll talk about that more in a minute. Andrea Boo, why are you qualified to serve on the city council?
Well, Steve, I have been an attorney for almost 20 years. And in that capacity, I've represented clients before city council. I have been a small business owner. In 2008, I left the practice of law to open a small business. And during that time, I saw the difficulties of opening and running a small business and what it takes to work with the city, the difficulties in obtaining a business license, the various departments that you have to go to obtain a license to open a business in Kansas City. And as I talk to voters throughout Kansas City, running and opening a small business is difficult. Also, when I returned to the practice of law, because I opened in 2008 when the economy was very bad, I represented municipalities in Kansas City throughout the region. And so I come at this from a perspective of not only having represented clients before city governments, but having been a small business owner as well.
Stacey, how about you? What qualifies you to serve on the Kansas City, Missouri City Council?
What qualifies me is the fact that I am an engaged citizen. When I try to think of the person that I want being my voice at City Council, it reflects someone who's engaged in their neighborhoods like I am. I am vice president of a coalition of 30-plus neighborhoods in my part of town. I am the voice of neighbors. We hear the development issues, and we are tasked with finding a responsible way of bringing development into our areas that's a win-win for both. I'm engaged in citizen committees on the council. Scott Taylor has appointed me as his appointee to two of the seats that he gets. One's PIAC, Public Improvement Advisory Committee, where we make recommendations about infrastructure projects across the city. Mm-hmm. And NTDF, Neighborhood Tourist Development Fund. And so I am in the neighborhoods. I'm across the city in all the district, hearing what the concerns are, what the interests are, and what the needs are. So I've been engaged in that for the last 12 years. So when a citizen needs their voice at City Hall, I am that person because I've been there doing the work.
Stacey, what kind of job do you think Mayor Sly James has done during his 8 years in office?
I think he's fine. The things about him that people most appreciate are the big things that he's done, you know, bringing the airport, streetcar, and those kind of things. And so what I'd like to do when I get there is I want to be a bold leader. I've been bold in my community and representing our voices. When it's time to go to City Hall, I'm there testifying. I'm not representing clients. I'm representing my peers, like my neighbors. And so when I get to City Hall, I want to be the one bringing bold new ideas to our city and leading and being able to lead because I've been engaged in the city and I'm involved and I know the areas that that we have great opportunities.
Andrea, how about you? What kind of job do you think the mayor's done?
I think he's done a great job of being the face of Kansas City, and that's the role of the mayor. I think the role of a council member is to work collaboratively with other council members to address the issues of the city. And as I talk with citizens and voters, they want a council that will get things done, that will deliver basic services efficiently and effectively, and address the issues of crime and affordable housing. And so as a council member, that's what I will do.
Well, let's talk about affordable housing. It's a big issue in this race. It applies to every one of our six council districts. Any plan to improve housing needs money, Stacey. Where's the city going to get it?
Okay. Well, that's something that a lot of people look for government to provide money for some of the housing we need. And we noticed that that's a problem. For example, the council passed a resolution with a $75 million housing trust fund without a single penny in it.
That's
I guess
right.
there's a little money in it from one effort, but it's not enough. And there's no way we're going to get it if we're going to rely on the city to find $75 million. So my thoughts are innovative. Again, I am a 32-year real estate professional. I'm in the housing industry. And of all of the candidates who are running, I'm the only one with direct housing and real estate experiences. Along with that, I bring my network.
So where's the money going to come from?
Okay, the money could come from private financing. So I have an action plan as a business person for my first 100 days in office, the things that citizens can look to me to do. And one of the things I want to do, Steve, is I want to convene a housing summit. I want to bring all people and all stakeholders in the housing industry to the table. I want to talk about it. I want to talk to investors, real estate agents, builders, neighborhood leaders, tenants. I want to talk to homeowners, financing people. I want us to all sit down and say, here's the problem, and then put some ideas and action plans on the plate for us to actually start solving them, get a plan in place, and implement it. And one of the ideas that I have is financing. Let investors, for the affordable housing we need, in the current inventory that we have that is dilapidated, let mm-hmm. investors, maybe the city can work with a lender and find some great financing and some financing that will allow them to renovate at a great cost and let them get the work done.
You know, Councilman Scott Wagner has put forward a plan to raise property taxes modestly to fund affordable housing. Can you support that?
Well, it depends. I'd like to see some of the details. But I think before that happens, and that would have to go to the citizens for a vote, we're losing time. When we could work as a city, we can work with lenders and ask them to put together some loans, some renovation loans, something with attractive rates and terms that will encourage the investors that are sitting on the sidelines to jump into this market. If there's a rehab loan that has a great interest rate, and great okay. terms, an investor may today say, hey, I'll go over to this particular area and I'll identify, you know, four or five homes that I can renovate or a couple of apartment buildings. And let's get that work started while we explore other options where we're relying on the government. But there are some options available to us with financing, private financing today.
Andrea Boo, where does the money for affordable housing come from? Where would you get it?
Well, Steve, I think we can't solely rely on the private side to fund affordable housing. I think we have to work with our nonprofits, and make it easier for nonprofits to address affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
Because let's face it, the development community is interested in making a profit. And if we don't work with organizations that are interested in addressing the affordable housing for low-income families, then we are not going to see this problem solved.
Where's affordable housing? Where's the nonprofit sector going to get the money to help get this job done?
You know, I think we have to look to the federal and state agencies. We have to push the state to reestablish the LIHTC program.
Which is what?
Low-income housing tax credit.
It's been taken off the table for a few years.
Right. Yeah. We do have to work with there's a program that is currently with the airport that provides low-interest loans for small businesses.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to come up with creative solutions that are that allow small businesses to invest in housing. We have to come up with a variety of solutions to fund this because, one, you know, raising taxes is not the only solution. And we have to come up with a variety of approach to solve this problem.
Could you support Scott Wegner's plan for a modest property tax increase?
Possibly, mm-hmm. because, as I said, it's not going to be a one solution to address this problem because $75 million is not going to solve our housing problem.
Stacy?
I'd like to follow up on that. Andrea mentioned the community development corporations. I happened to serve on a board of one of them. It was the Swope Community Builders, formerly called that. And at that particular time, for about 10 years, my goal was to support, as a board member, that organization in identifying resources and sources for affordable housing. That was our task. And most of those homes were in the 3rd and the 5th District. And so supporting those organizations was really important to me. And at the same time, it was disappointing to me that my opponent was on a legal team that actually took resources from that organization to fight a legal battle. And I'm sure it's not her choice. It was a job. But at the same time, I think it was just ironic that at the same time, I'm working on one side of the issue to bring affordable housing into the neighborhoods. And she's on the other side where they were taking resources from that very organization that could have been used for housing.
Andrew, do you want to address that?
I'm not sure what Ms. Cosby-Johnson is talking about, if she could be more specific.
There was a team on Swope Community Builders. You served as an attorney in a particular asset. There was an asset that the Swope Community Builders had a dispute about.
I don't think it had anything to do with housing.
No. My point is that organization, fighting that legal battle took money away from housing opportunities. And so I'm saying we were on both sides of the issue there. And I also served on the board. I currently serve on the board of the St. Michael's Veteran Place Apartments, where we house currently 117 formerly homeless veterans. And to do phase three, we're going to need LIHTC. We're going to need funding. And so I was very active in asking the governor on multiple occasions to please consider reinstating LIHTC. And in my work with homeless students in South Kansas City, that'll be important.
Andrew, anything else you want to say here?
I just want to say that I have not served on any legal team that took any funds away from any housing projects.
Not directly. That's right.
Okay. Andrea, what's your stance on tax incentives for developers? Where does the city need to go there? And I'm wondering, is there any room for tax incentives going forward for downtown development, or do you want to see the focus shift exclusively to the east side?
I think the city needs to remain flexible on their tax incentive programs, but we must ensure that there is a community benefit as we approve further tax incentive programs. So I'm not going to say that yes or no to any specific program, but we must ensure that not only does it satisfy the but-for test, but it also satisfies a community benefit.
Philosophically, do you support the idea of giving an incentive to a developer and saying, okay, you get the incentive, but in return, you've got to set aside 20% of your units for affordable housing or low-income housing? Is that something that you could get behind?
I think in theory, yes, that we could get behind a program to address the affordable housing that if you are going to provide housing in one instance, that there has to be affordable housing in another instance. But I think what is key, Steve, is that we must address what affordable housing means, because we are not doing a very good job right now of defining affordable.
And maybe some folks think what the definition is skews for richer folks instead of folks who are really down in the trenches. Stacey, how do you approach the whole notion of tax incentives for developers?
Well, I think we need to approach it carefully. And there's a reason now that a lot of the citizens are not in favor of the tax incentives. And I think part of that problem is a lack of transparency. So when people are going to the polls and selecting a council member, they need to trust pick someone they can trust to make those decisions. So I support them, and I support actually finding and identifying strategically as a council the areas where we're going to focus. And if the area of most focus is in the 3rd district, then we need to identify that and strategically determine how we're going to solicit for developers to come into that area. And I don't think we've necessarily done a good job selling the areas and some of the different tools they can use, because it's not just about TIF, but we can use opportunity zones and various other programs that are out there and financing tools to entice developers to build where we need them to build.
Is there still room for tax incentives for folks who want to build east downtown and not just east of Troost?
I would say that as a priority now, I'm going to say that that's probably not going to be popular with the citizens, because a lot of that development's already happened and those tax incentives have been fully used in that area.
And let's support further incentives for downtown development, or are you putting a clamp on that?
At this particular point, let's put a clamp on it for a while and let's look at other areas that are in need and spend some time focusing on those, in particular the 3rd District, 5th District, and there's some areas in the 6th District. And I'd also like to say the Northland has a great opportunity for housing. If we need to increase the number of citizens that we have in our city, and it comes from the residential development, there's 15,000 acres in the Northland in Twin Creeks where there's an opportunity for 75% of those acres to be used for residential development. Yeah. So let's look at those areas strategically and determine how we want to apply the tax incentives or not.
Andrea, there's a cap. There's a question on the ballot in June that would cap the amount of property tax abatements available to assist developers at 50% of what's allowed by state law. Good idea or not?
No.
Because
it takes a tool away from the toolbox of the city. And the city council needs flexibility in that there are areas of the city that need economic development. Mm-hmm. And if we take that off of the table, it limits the ability to advance economic development in those areas of the city.
Stacey, could you get behind this 50% cap on incentives?
Absolutely not. It ties our hands. I happened to be in a meeting north of the river with one of the EDCs there. And what they said is that in a meeting where they were having that conversation, two of the closer municipalities, I think it was either Parkville and Riverside, specifically said, hey, we hope that goes into effect in Kansas City, because they know then that they would get the benefit of those developers and being able to use that tool there. We need to trust the people we put in place at City Hall to choose the projects carefully. And I would say what I would do is make sure that that process is transparent up front and that citizens are engaged and involved up front in any proposals that we discuss.
We're talking with the 2-6 district at-large candidates for the Kansas City Council, Andrea Boo, Stacey Johnson-Cosby. There's a new group in town, the Kansas City Tenants Group, that's advocating for a tenants' bill of rights that covers topics like rent affordability and evictions. Stacey, do you support a tenants' bill of rights?
It depends on what's in it, but of course I support tenants having rights. And we had a forum this past weekend, and what I shared at that particular point, I'll share today. There is absolutely, it is not acceptable for any tenant to be living in unsanitary, unsafe, unclean, unhealthy, undignified housing, period. There is no excuse for that, and it's not safe, and it's not right. And by the same token, when we have slumlords, the very ones who are operating those types of properties, the city had the opportunity for years through our ordinances to put them out of business, and the city did not do that. So when you have someone that is violating those tenants' rights and not maintaining the property in a healthy, dignified manner, the city needs to shut them down, and we need to focus on what we need to do to get more responsible landlords in our marketplace and not do a lot of big umbrella type moves that actually penalize the good landlords.
Andrea, tenants' bill of rights, do you like that idea?
I do like that idea, but I think what distinguishes me from my opponent is my opponent was against the Healthy Homes Ordinance, and she refused to sign off at the forum this Saturday on the tenants' bill of rights. And while every candidate that was there did, and to some degree, not everyone agreed with every point, she did not agree to sign off on
What about that, Stacey?
Okay, what about that is that I'm not going to sign a piece of paper that arbitrarily says what I agree or don't agree with. I want to put into action the things that I want to do. As I mentioned up front when that was given to the questionnaire was sent to us, I told Tara that I would sit down. I want to bring landlords to the table with tenants. Let's sit down and figure out the areas that we can work together on to solve the problem. Signing a piece of paper doesn't solve a problem. Sitting down face-to-face does. And I also mentioned at that particular time that we need more landlords like my husband. We have tenants. We house formerly homeless veterans, and we pay all of their utilities for them. They don't have to write a check. All of our tenants, we pay their water bills, and a lot of people complain this day about water bills. We take care of that for our tenants, and we provide housing for them in a responsible manner. And what we need to do is we need to focus on finding other landlords who have a compassion and who can be flexible with our tenants. Because I've mentioned at that particular forum that we give second chances to felons, and we house them, and to people who've been evicted. And those are big components in those tenants' bills of rights and their policy.
All right.
And what I'm saying, we just have a different way of getting there. We need to protect the tenants, but I have a different way of getting there. Mine is actions-based and solutions-based because I want to get some stuff solved.
One of the biggest issues, obviously, going forward is crime. It's much talked about in this community. Andrea, what's the path forward? Do you need to hire more police officers? Do you want local control of the police department? Where are we going here?
I think you have to have a multifaceted approach, and one of those is hiring more police officers so they can be responsive, build community relations. But you also have to address the underlying root causes, that is access to mental health, substance abuse programs, living wage jobs, affordable housing. That is a key to solving.
Arguably, we have some of those things already in place.
Right, but we have to do more because we are not solving the violent crime issue. But yes, we are not staffed at a level that we were, 10 years ago.
Why do we need more officers when we're already devoting, again, we've talked about it on the show any number of times in these forums, 76-77% of the general fund to public safety, including firefighting, to be sure. But that's a pretty big chunk.
That is a huge chunk. But we do not we're not staffing at a level that allows officers to do more than be responsive to the crimes. We are not engaging in community.
They can't slow down and build relations
with
the residents, you're saying. Yeah.
I was talking to the president of the Fraternal Order of Police, and when he was on patrol, he was able to sit down and talk and build relationships with the residents so that there could be a responsiveness between the citizens so that they felt a level of comfort and in contacting the police when there were issues. And I think we don't have that now, whether it's, all around Kansas City.
Stacey Johnson-Cosby, what's your platform on dealing with the city's violent crime problem?
We need to solve it. We need to work together as a community. What we've done so far has not worked. And so in my action plan...
Why hasn't it worked?
I think we don't have necessarily the right people at the table. I have an action plan, like I mentioned before, for my first 100 days in office. And I want to talk about it, Steve. And so within the first 100 days, I'm going to pull together a violent crime reduction summit. I want all stakeholders, again, at the table. We need community leaders. We need police officers.
That may be a great idea, but this community has done summits. It's done big meetings. And still we sit here and sort of flounder in terms of finding a way forward.
It's not always about the meetings, but you have to have the right people leading the meetings. People like me that not only when I convene meetings, it's not just for the sake of meeting, but to get an action plan out of it. As a business person and as a successful neighborhood leader, I have a track record in getting things done and accomplishing things. So I'd like to try my tent as hand at the table. And like I said, I want law enforcement, I want mental health professionals, community leaders, and some of the organizations that are doing the work now, neighborhood leaders. We need to be at the table talking about the problem and as a community working to solve it.
More police officers?
Absolutely, because that is needed. We had 135 murders last year, and we're in the top five in the country for violent crimes. That's not acceptable to me. Those are 135 lives lost. When we had our budget hearings this year, when the public had come to them, I went to all of the budget hearings on Saturday mornings at 9 o'clock across the city because I noticed that in the proposed budget, there were zero new police officers, and that to me is unacceptable when we know we have a problem. And so I lobbied for it each and every time, and by the third meeting, one of the council members member said, hey, we're going to look at this. And by the time it was all said and done, we had 12 new officers in the budget.
What's the answer going beyond police officers? I mean, a lot of folks say police officers can't solve this problem alone.
Okay, what we need to do is we need to help those parents, because when you look at who's committing the crimes, a lot of them are young people. And I was at a town hall at St. James, I think in the last month and a half, where there were mothers of murdered children there, and a lot of them were young men. And on the stage, one of the panel members worked with one of the local organizations and said, we have these activities available for young people. One of the mothers sitting there on the front row holding a picture of her murdered son said, I didn't know about those programs. She said, my son would have liked to participate in those. Hmm. So that told me something. That was eye-opening for me and sobering. And it told me that we need to make those programs that are out already available, we need to make them available to the students and to young people and to parents as a tool. Okay. And I'll have a directory on my website listing all of those programs and resources available.
How about local control of the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department, Andrea Boo? Is that a good idea?
I don't think it addresses the violent crime problem.
Yeah.
It's something that can be on the table.
Stacey, how about you?
I'd like to talk about it a little bit more to see on all sides of the issues if that is indeed the best way to resolve the problem. Because we have local control of the budget, which in a sense does that.
Early childhood education, a big plan just got defeated in Kansas City. Do you want the next city council to put another plan forward?
I think what we need to do is focus on city business and leave the business of schools to the school district. They're the experts there. And that's something that our council needs to look towards, experts.
So that's a no then.
Well, for me, there are ways to support them. For example, I'm part of two collective impact groups within our communities. I'm in the Center School District and Hickman Middle School District. Between those districts, we have 700 homeless students. And we're working to eliminate homelessness in 3 years amongst those students. So there are things as a community that we can do to support those families and education and school districts.
Andrea Boo, do you want to take another crack at early childhood education?
No, I think the school districts and school administrators should lead on education policy.
Okay. We're going to leave our conversation there with our 2-6 district at-large candidates for the Kansas City Council. The election is a week from today. Andrea Boo, Stacey Johnson-Cosby, thank you both very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
And thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about modern-day slavery. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, Kansas City Council candidates for the 3rd District at-large seat shared their plans for engaging their communities and providing easier access to jobs. Hear that and other previous episodes. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we'll talk with a sociologist from Kansas City who says right-wing policies are putting white Americans' health at risk. His new book is called Dying of Whiteness. Join us tomorrow for that conversation. Well, think of slavery, and chances are you think of the way things once were in this country, with human beings tethered to chains and sold prior to the Civil War. But it's a modern-day phenomenon, too. These days, the UN estimates that more than 40 million victims of human trafficking are forced to engage in commercial sex or labor under the threat of physical or financial harm. The threat in the U.S., the number in the U.S. reaches into the hundreds of thousands. Recent research here showed that there were nearly 80 illicit massage parlors in the Kansas City metro alone. These parlors are often homes to those being trafficked. With us to talk about this is Victor Boutros. He's the founding director and CEO of the Human Trafficking Institute based in Virginia. He's a former member of the U.S. Justice Department's Human Trafficking Prosecution Unit. He speaks tonight at the Kansas City Public Library. More on that in a moment. Victor, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Also with us is Teresa Moore. She's the first assistant U.S. attorney in Kansas City. Prior to her recent appointment to first assistant, she led the Federal Human Trafficking Initiative in the Western District of Missouri as a unit chief for the Computer Crimes and Child Exploitation Unit. Teresa, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Steve.
Now, we hear a lot about this issue, but how can the typical Kansas Cityan, Teresa, recognize it? I mean, experts say that crime is happening everywhere, but how can regular folks even spot it?
I think there's a couple of different things
people can do. One thing certainly is what they're doing today, listening to your show, becoming educated about the issues surrounding human trafficking, labor trafficking, commercial sex trafficking.
Right.
And there's a number of resources they can look to on the internet. Certainly go see Victor tonight at the public library. And another thing is just to be aware of their surroundings. If something doesn't look right, report that information to the police. If there's a minor that they think is in a location that minor shouldn't be, or it seems like there's something wrong, report it to the police.
Yeah. Victor, what would you add to that?
I think that's actually a really good summary. I think a lot of people will see things that don't look right, and they because they're not sure that that's what's happening, they're reluctant to report it. But I think a safer practice is just to report it and let the law enforcement folks sort through it.
You know, the recent arrest of Robert Kraft, the owner of the New England Patriots, he was picked up in a sex trafficking bust. How much light did his arrest place on this issue of trafficking, Victor, as you get around the country?
Well, I think it certainly elevated the profile of human trafficking just by being in the news and sort of on the front pages of our newspapers all the time. But I think that's important because trafficking is such a hidden crime that really you can hear a show like this and actually be quite compelled by it and then not even think about it for the next 2-3 years because it's so hidden and it's so hard to see. And so I think having that in our public awareness helps us be conscious of what's happening around us and hopefully report things that could lead to cases.
You know, Teresa, how can it be so hidden when there are so many victims of this right in our midst? How does that happen?
Well, traffickers don't they're trying to avoid law enforcement. They're trying to avoid people understanding what's happening. So they do it in a way that they advertise on websites that the general public may not go to. They avoid as much contact with law enforcement. They encourage victims not to contact law enforcement or even others and answer questions that might lead to the discovery of this trafficking aspect of what's happening.
I was really struck. The 2018 Federal Human Trafficking Report said the federal government initiated charges that year against 297 defendants in human trafficking cases. That was a 34% decrease from the 450 defendants the federal government charged the previous year. Does that decline suggest the government is getting a handle on this issue, Victor?
I think there's a lot of I think that everybody's noticed that the numbers have gone down, and there's a lot of kind of soul searching on the DOJ side to figure out, okay, what's happening and how can we also increase our cases and numbers. Backpage, which is one of the websites perhaps that Teresa was referencing a moment ago, used to be a source for sex traffickers to advertise their victims to the public. That website was shut down by the FBI about a year ago. And so that potentially could lead to fewer cases just because it's also a loss of an investigative tool. I think that people are trying to figure out what explains that decrease and if it's just a blip, if it's a trend or if it's just a statistical blip and we'll bounce back next year.
Teresa Moore, what do you think it is?
I think there's a number of factors. One, Backpage did provide good leads for law enforcement, but I can tell you that the agents that we work with and also local law enforcement continue to work a number of cases. So I'm not exactly
sure.
They're not
bored.
No. And they remain very active, both handle proactive investigations and reactive investigations. I'm not sure, again, if it's just a blip, but certainly it's a priority of the Department of Justice and a priority in our office in the Western District of Missouri.
We're talking about the modern day problem of slavery, sex trafficking, labor abuse. Our phone number here, if you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. I was also struck by the fact that more than 96% of the defendants charged in 2018 were in sex trafficking cases as opposed to labor trafficking cases. Does that suggest that, I guess, maybe without a doubt, that sex trafficking remains by far the bigger issue here?
I do think it is the bigger issue here. I think also the Department of Labor has been proactive in some labor investigations and forced labor investigations and can handle things that necessarily don't fall in the criminal realm. But yeah, in our district, I would we have had more sex trafficking cases than labor trafficking
cases. That's interesting. You know, Victor, I'm also struck by this idea that there's been a lot of attention directed at human trafficking in recent years. It seems to have emerged from the shadows and has become occasionally a front page story. How much of a difference has that made?
Well, I think it's as one of my friends sometimes put it, you can't do anything without awareness. If you're not aware of it, you're not going to make much progress. But awareness alone isn't going to solve the problem. So I think it has helped. I think it has moved from the periphery. When I first learned about this 20 years ago, it was just on nobody's radar.
Yeah.
And I think it has kind of moved into the center to the point where even in less than a 12-month period, we had sort of every major branch of the U.S. government at the highest levels from the executive to the judicial to the legislative branch ask for briefings on human trafficking. So I think there is it has moved into a central role in our policy discussions.
In any sense of why that change occurred?
I think there are some great organizations that have done a good job helping people understand what's happening and taking it out of the shadows, this hidden crime out of the shadows, and helping people understand that it's happening and where it's happening and how it works.
Has the federal government's focus on this issue, Teresa, has it changed in recent years? Is there more attention being paid to it now or less? Or put it in context for us a little bit.
In 2006, at least in the Western District of Missouri, our office started a task force. And so for the last 13 years, we've continued to participate. The focus has remained, at least among other crimes, obviously, but we do have a priority for human trafficking cases and have continued to develop cases over the years.
Are these tough cases to crack?
They are tough cases.
Why?
You know,
the crime is so horrific. I mean,
the crime is horrific, but many victims, or I should say most victims, have been conditioned by their traffickers not to trust law enforcement. So that's one of the first issues that law enforcement has to deal with.
They're indoctrinated early on. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And they're indoctrinated to avoid law enforcement. And so law enforcement has to take really a victim-centered approach to investigating these cases. And a lot of the victims have suffered very traumatic experiences. And so that's another issue that has to be addressed. They need resources in the community. We work with community partners to provide resources to the victims. But some of the cases take a long time to investigate. The traffickers travel from city to city.
They keep moving intentionally.
They do. A lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them do. And so the investigation may involve a number of different jurisdictions. And so they do take some time to put together.
I mean, how does law enforcement even keep track of what's going on? How do you get tips? How does that work? How do you get your information?
So there's a number of ways. Law enforcement does proactive investigations where they monitor certain websites or conduct undercover investigations. We get tips from the public. We get tips from just individuals, citizens, from businesses, tips from certainly the medical personnel may contact the Children's Services Division and they contact law enforcement. So a number of different ways.
A tip from a business might be there's an empty storefront next door to mine and I'm seeing some traffic coming and going at weird hours. You ought to know about it. Is it that kind of thing?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. You can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to some calls. And Chris from Kansas City, Missouri. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi. I work in the anti-trafficking field, and I am very familiar with Teresa and her work. And I just have to say I'd really like to commend the Western District of Missouri and the local area police departments for the excellent work they've done in this field. Our agency is a community partner in the Coalition Against Human Trafficking, and these people have done remarkable work. And one thing that I would like your participants to talk about is the idea of addressing the demand side of human trafficking and why it's important to do that.
Chris, and before you go, are the good guys winning in this fight? Do you see the pendulum swinging back?
I think you get your victories. We get our victories. And I think a lot of progress has been made, not only in the catching of the bad guys who are perpetrating on the victims. Services for victims are getting better. But where I really see a lot of growth is in the area of prevention and education, because that's a good area to go to. Plus, we really need to address the buyers, the demand side, because it's a lot more difficult to sell if you don't have as many people buying.
Let's talk about that. And Chris, I appreciate your phone call. Victor Boutros, again, CEO of the Human Trafficking Institute based in Virginia. And I should say that he'll be speaking this evening at 6:30 on human trafficking, today's slavery, at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Public Library. To grab a seat, RSVP at kclibrary.org. What about the demand side? How do we begin to take a bite out of that?
So, yeah, the question is really about the demand for commercial sex. And we have seen more and more shifts into looking at enforcement against what sometimes are referred to as Johns, people who are purchasers of commercial sex. And we've even seen in the federal human trafficking report that you've referenced a rise in purchaser cases over the last several years. And there's some evidence coming out of a Scandinavian model that can reduce demand over time.
And what reduces it exactly?
Enforcement against Johns. That when you are a purchaser of commercial sex and you're caught and you have a more meaningful penalty, then that can actually reduce demand.
Is there a problem in the way we go after this issue? Are we not focusing enough on the demand side? Is that sort of part of Chris's point here?
I think it's not an either or; it's a both and. So we don't want to neglect the importance of going after the demand of purchasers of commercial sex. But I think the other thing that to me it can be actually encouraging is, and I know some people when we talk about the demand issue feel like, well, if you have to end the demand of primarily men for commercial sex to be successful, it feels like that's an impossible hill to climb. But I think the other thing that we can do in addition to targeting the demand for commercial sex is move up one level and say, can we actually end the demand of the trafficker for forced commercial sex? So that when a trafficker realizes, wait a second, if I use force or threats or violence, or if I'm coercing someone who's underage, then someone like Teresa or in Teresa's office, the U.S. Attorney's office, some of my old colleagues at the Human Trafficking Prosecution Unit could actually come and I could actually look at a very significant sentence. It's just not worth it to use force and threats and violence to coerce someone to end this. And then you move up one level and you begin to end the demand of the trafficker to engage in the crime. Mm-hmm. And that's when we start to see big drops in prevalence that I think is the game changer in this space.
Teresa Moore with the U.S. Attorney's Office. What would you add here in terms of what needs to happen to deal with the demand side?
You know, we have some good statutory tools to deal with the demand side. And we have prosecuted a number of individuals, customers or Johns. Again, it's as Victor said, not either or. We need to focus on traffickers and customers as well to really make a dent in the demand for victims.
I gather that when you go after the purchasers on the retail side, just guessing, does word spread pretty quickly? Does that word get out and suddenly people get the idea?
I think word can spread quickly online, and that changes some of their online tools that they use to find victims. And so sometimes law enforcement has to stay ahead of the purchasers talking to each other online, and that can be difficult to do.
Okay, let's go back to some calls here. And Diana from Overland Park. Diana, you're on Up to Date.
Yeah, this is Imani. I actually reported to the police just the proliferation of massage parlors all over Olathe. And it seemed to be following a certain pattern. They were massage parlors, nail salons, and either payday lending or video services. And they were all kind of grouped together. Do the police use a reactive or a proactive approach to going after this problem? Do they set up stings, or do they have to wait until someone actually says that they are a victim of this?
Victor?
So the answer is both happen. So there is both reactive enforcement, where you are getting tips from either victims or outcry witnesses, people the victims talk to, or as Teresa referenced, medical providers, first providers, police. But there are also increasingly it's important to actually do proactive investigations where, because this is a continuing offense, it's not like an episode offense where you have a bank robbery that starts at 9 a.m. and ends at 9:15 and someone raises their hand and says, I'm a victim of a bank robbery, come help me. The person who's trafficked could be trafficked for a period of years and isn't free to go raise their hand and say, I'm a victim of trafficking. And as Teresa pointed out, are often so frightened by the traffickers of law enforcement that they think they're sometimes told, hey, law enforcement's just going to bring you right back to me and you're going to get the beating of your life. And so they're very wary of law enforcement. And so it is very important in this space to do proactive investigations where you're actually engaging undercover operations to go find the crime.
Okay, let's go to Steve from Kansas City. Steve, you're on the show.
Hi, thank you. I had a question more on the supply side, and just curious if you could share anything with us about who these victims are, you know, where they come from. Is there certain demographics, or some of them, you know, quote-unquote normal kids that are, you know, engaged in this and then go home and live under their parents' roofs, unbeknownst to the parents, kind of in a double life type thing, or anything on how people are finding themselves in this or where they're, you know, coming
yeah.
from.
Teresa?
Thank you for the call, Steve. Victims can really come from any segment of the population. I do think that vulnerable victims, victims who may be struggling with homelessness issues or other types of issues may be more vulnerable to traffickers, but traffickers often recruit victims online, and that can be anyone in their own home. And we have had instances of parents not knowing their children were being recruited, where they have been picked up by a trafficker and then returned back home. And so really there's no set demographic of where victims come from. It's more likely sometimes they might be vulnerable for a reason, but they really can come from any segment of the population.
You know, you're scaring a lot of parents out there when you talk like that. I mean, I know it's the reality, but what can parents do?
You know, it's very difficult, and I've really wrestled with this as a parent myself. I think the best thing is to have an open communication, but having raised teenagers, I know that can be difficult sometimes.
We've tried different
things in our own family with limiting access to the internet and cell phones, but they're ubiquitous. Everybody has them, and you need to, you know, address how to teach your kids to responsibly respond to people online. So it's difficult, and I don't have any great one answer for that other than to, as a parent, try to engage your child and be vigilant about what's happening.
Okay, we're going to have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Teresa Moore, First Assistant U.S. Attorney here in Kansas City, Victor Boutros, the founding director and CEO of the Human Trafficking Institute based in Virginia. He'll be speaking tonight at 6:30 at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Public Library. He'll be taking more questions there. To grab a seat, RSVP at kclibrary.org. Thank you both very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. Follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Friday on the show, NPR national correspondent Sarah McCammon joins us in studio to talk about her upbringing in Kansas City and what she's reporting on now. Join us Friday for that conversation. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Emily Aiken. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.